This is Dick Brunton, and Dick's going to give us his story. Thank you, Dick.
Well, my experience has basically started off much the same as Vic's. I was in the territorials before the war started, in the medical corps. I was interested in St. John's and all that sort of stuff, you know. And, of course, we were mobilised in August 1939, shot off into Wairua and so forth. My best mate was in the second echelon in the army, and I tried to transfer over to go with him in the artillery, and the colonel would have nothing to do with it. But he couldn't do anything with me because I was underage at this point of time. So on the way back from camp on leave, we were passing the TNG building in Napier, and the Air Force had a sign out to the effect that the selection committee was in residence and looking for recruits. So I thought, oh, bugger this, I'll do this. I'm not going to muck around with the army. I didn't feel like patching up people. I'd rather be in a more active situation. So I went in and volunteered, and I was in uniform, so I was more or less accepted on the spot. Well, everything seemed to happen in a hurry from then on. Went to night school, did the assignments which normally take, well, the 21 assignments, they usually take a year. And on their first night they said, sorry chaps, it's going to be 6 months to do the 21. And the next night we went along and said, sorry, it's going to be 3 months to do your 21, they're short of pilots. So I gave up my work and got stuck into that. Anyway, that's the story at that point. We shot off to Levin. I don't remember how long we're at Levin. And from there, well, I went to Funurpi for a while first as an AC2 assistant to the barrack warden or something. And then I went down to Levin, and from there I went to elementary flying school at Tyree. I went solo. We're flying Tiger Moths. I think I went solo at 6 hours from memory and did our time there. Sent home on leave, expecting to have a couple of weeks. And God, I hadn't got home more than 48 hours, and I had a telegram, report to Auckland pronto. So hiked off to Auckland, and we were on the ship at 9 o'clock in the morning and gone before we could blink our eyes. We went on this Dutch cargo come passenger ship, the Bloemfontein, and we took 3 weeks to get over to America. It was a lovely trip. It was one of the most enjoyable, if it wasn't for the fact there was a war on. And we landed at St. Pedro, just out of Los Angeles, had a couple of days there, and the Americans really made us very, very welcome. This would have been early in 1942. I entered the Air Force in 1941. We got on the Southern Pacific Streamliner, which was absolute luxury. It was absolutely magnificent. And we were doing 115 miles an hour, according to the speedo on the ceiling. We arrived at a place called Martinez, just out of San Francisco, and they said, oh, your train's waiting for you from Canada. And it was the most beaten up, filthy, dirty, bloody thing you ever saw in all your life. We went right along all the carriages and got all their toilet rolls and all the paper towels. We had to clean all the crap and coal dust and stuff off all the seats before we could even sit down on them. What a come down from that luxury thing. It was air conditioned and everything. Anyway, I ended up in Calgary. I went to Edmonton, then down to Calgary. While we were at Edmonton, they asked for volunteers to go down to what was an RAF station in Calgary. So 20 of us volunteered and went down to Calgary, where we did our service flying training on this RAF station. There were 1,800 RAF there and 120 pilots going through. We were flying Oxfords, and they were vicious little buggers if ever there was. But anyway, my instructor, I had two or three instructors, and the last one I had tried to do me in on a couple of occasions. He froze on the controls when I was doing an emergency landing. So anyway, I managed to take over, and he woke up then. It was all right. But the second time, he really had me. I was under the hood doing an instrument takeoff. I had another pupil with me, Danny Kilgour, who unfortunately was killed later on. And I thought I was doing all right. I was heading off down the runway, wide open throttles, and steering on the old gyro to try and, you know, keep my track right. And then the instructor said, I've got her. I must have got off the runway or something. And then I felt the bloody thing lift off the ground, and it stalled and hit the ground again and bounced and stalled again and bounced. And I thought, shit, I'm not staying under the hood any longer. So I put the old hood off. And here we were going over the end of the runway down into a gully, head first. And I thought, oh, shit, this isn't any good to me. And I looked at the instructor. Oh, it was all very quick, of course. Anyway, I grabbed the controls and I give it a hell of a yank. And fortunately, we hit the other side on our belly instead of hitting nose first. The engines were no wheels. They wiped the wheels off, it wiped the props off, and the engines were screaming away, so I shut those down, got out of my seat quick as I could, rushed down the back. Danny Kilgour already had the door open, and we turned around, and the instructor was still bloody sitting there. So anyway, we rushed back and pulled the pin out of his harness and grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and dragged him out of the aircraft, and then he snapped out of it. Anyway, I remember running from there. I took off as fast as I could caper, about, a good 100 yards, 150 yards, to where their fire engine was with all their fire crew. And I always remember as I passed this first Canadian, a great big bloke, he said, "By God, laddie," he said, "you should go and take a ticket in the Irish sweep." And I said, "What for?" "He said, well, look around you." And you know, the grass was all tall fescue about this high, and it was as white as snow. It was in the middle of summer, and it was saturated with petrol through about 100 yards in all directions, right around. So it only needed a bit of a spark, and the whole lot would have just gone woof. That would have been the end of it. Anyway, I got away with that. From there, I was commissioned at that point on graduation. There was only four of us out of 120 got commissioned, and went to Penfield Ridge, where I ran into Vic again. And that's how our paths started to cross, and we did our OTU on Venturas. They weren't a bad aircraft. They were sort of a one-speed thing. You're landing and you take off and you're flying and everything is all sort of one speed. But I was very lucky. I was the only one out of the whole lot, I think, that didn't have to put down somewhere for engine failure of one sort or another. There was something wrong with the maintenance of the aircraft, and the Pratt & Whitney chap came up from down the States to try and sort them out. Anyway, from there, went down to New York and got on the Queen Elizabeth with 19,500 others on board, and we went solo across the Atlantic. We really motored, I can tell you. I've never realised that a ship of 87,000 tonnes could do 46 knots, which it did.
It's a huge speed, yes.
We really motored. Anyway, we arrived in Greenock, and we were getting off the ship, or just about to disembark, and the tannoy went with Pilot Officer Brunton turn up at the ship's commanding officer's office, so I went down. "Oh, Brunton," he said, "you're in charge of train 16 to take it down to Bournemouth." Oh, I said, "I don't know anything about taking up a train anywhere, you know." "Not to worry," he said, "there's plenty of help." So anyway, that was my first introduction to Britain. So we stopped in and out of tunnels on the way down, arrived in Bournemouth at about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, I suppose. Went off to the Royal Bath Hotel, and we just put our gear in the dormitory there upstairs, and all hell broke loose. And I looked out the window, and here were these bloody Focke-Wulf 190s, and they were machine gunning kids in the street and people on the lawns and dropping bombs, and it all went wrong. And one of the bombs, I saw it coming straight at me, and I thought, "Oh dear, oh dear," under the bed. But anyway, it went between the chimneys and landed on the beach, which was down below the cliff. We were up on a cliff. So that was all right. That was my first introduction to the war. There was a war on. From there we went to, placed over near Buckingham, converted on to Mitchell's, then was posted to 226 Squadron at Swanton Morley, which is just out of Norwich, about 20 miles west of Norwich. It wasn't very long, of course, that we went on our first op. Being a new chum, of course, you usually got the worst place on this. It was all daylight stuff, by the way. We did all our bombing in daylight. And it was always in formation too. So you were usually RSN Charlie, which was number 5 or number 6, right at the back, where they could pick you off easy. We went over to somewhere in France and dropped our bombs. And on the way back, suddenly ran out of gas. One engine stopped. And I thought, oh dear, you know, something's wrong. And I checked on the petrol tanks and there's no gas. I thought, well, this isn't any good. So anyway, I transferred what fuel I had over to the other motor. And I yelled out to old Stan, my navigator, you know, where's the nearest airfield? And he said, we're in between two, so I thought, well, I'll keep on going. And just as we approached this airfield, the other motor cut. So I did a dead stick landing. I managed to get in all right. I tipped it up sideways to get between a couple of trees and dropped it down on the grass airfield. And I always sort of remember this particular one because I'd no sooner come to a standstill than a Jeep rolls up and the fella's standing up, "You can't go all land here. The aerodrome's unserviceable." Yes, I could have jumped out. I said, if you'd been in the road, I'd have landed on top of you. I had no choice. It happened to be an aerodrome that the Americans had decided to abandon because it wasn't fit for human habitation. So anyway, we got petrol from them, and well, actually, while I was there, I can remember another Jeep turned up, and it was an American colonel and two or three of his other officers. And oh, they made a real fuss of us, you know, because we'd been on an op, it's obvious. And anyway, I made arrangements with him to get petrol. Well, of course, we never saw him again. He didn't show up for a couple of hours or so. So we made our way to the mess, and I was in the mess when the phone went, and I said, "Oh, phone for you." So I went onto the phone, and this fellow on the end of it, there was a POM. He said, "I think you're most discourteous." He said, "You didn't bother to come and see me." And I said, "Who the hell are you?" And he said, "I'm squadron leader so-and-so." He said, "I'm the CO of the station." I said, "Are you just? Well, why the hell didn't you come out and see us, give us a helping hand, see what was wrong? He said, I'm the CO. And I said, I don't give a stuff what you are. All I want is bloody petrol. And I said, you can stick your bloody station up your arse. So anyway, we got petrol and Julie arrived back on the squadron and the bloody CO tore a strip off me because I'd done a false landing. I always laugh about that. He said, how in the hell did you run out of petrol? Because we were well within our range. Oh, I said, what was the number of the aircraft? He said, oh, Z for zebra. I said, that's the oldest bloody aeroplane you've got on the books. And he said, yes, it is. I said, yeah, well, it munches up petrol like nobody's business. They got rid of it anyway, so I got a new one then. But that was my story up to that point. While I was on the squadron, I was on the squadron for nearly 2 years, and I had all sorts of various jobs to do. I went up to Drem and did some trials with this aluminium foil that they call window. Did the trials for them up there along with another one of our aircraft, and we used to go out over the North Sea and drop this stuff out at different rates and so forth. We experimented with it while the boffins in what was called Tintallon Castle, right on the edge of the water, they had this old castle there, and they worked out the quantities needed, and that knowledge was used on D-Day from several different areas in the English Channel to bluff the German radar because they didn't know where the landing was going to take place. It bluffed them for quite a while. They thought there was an armada of ships coming in near Antwerp was one place, and there were two other places that they dropped the stuff so that the Germans were confused and they didn't know where to send the emergency troops.
They called it window, didn't they?
Window. Yes, we did the trials on that. We also were the first squadron to get what they call the G-Box, which was a little bit more advanced radar for navigation purposes. It was run on the basis of there were three beacons which shifted, you know, frequently in England. And you can imagine a stone being thrown into a pond, how the waves radiate out from it. Well, that was what their signals were like. And we had three different frequencies, and our machines were picking up these signals, and wherever these radiations crossed, intersected, we knew exactly where we were all the time. So we could fly along one of these, well, we'd call it a beam, I suppose, and we've actually bombed in 10/10 cloud, and bombed very accurately because we had this equipment. To start off with, we were used as bait, of course, as this was a bigger aircraft. We carried 4,000 pounds of bombs, and this is where Max and these other gentlemen come in the picture. They came along as fighter escort. They were very useful too, I might add. It was very nice to have them along. But they were up very high, and then they were close escort. And we had one occasion when we had a Polish squadron of fighters escorting us, close escort. And when we were over France, they saw this black speck away to hell and gone on the horizon, inland, unfortunately, and the whole bloody lot of them took off after it. And left us sitting up there like a proverbial dog's whatnot. Wasn't much fun either. We got fairly busy around D-Day. I wasn't actually in the landing, but we were bombing sometimes 2-3 ops a day. And about a fortnight before D-Day, I was sent to Boscombe Down, the experimental station, to do intensive flying trials on a new aircraft at the time called a Bristol Buckingham, which was a shocker. But it was very fast and had the most wonderful engines, Bristol Centaurus. That's when we first encountered them. And we had two of those on, you know, twin-engine aircraft, and it was swinging four-bladed 14-foot six props. And when you open the throttle for those things, it just literally sucked you off the ground. They were fantastic things. But that was one place where one of our previous fellows was saying, they took us along and said, this is the cockpit, and that's the throttle, and that's the flaps, and that's that. Now get in and fly it. Which we did, of course, but it was a little bit of fun for a while. But that was very fast, but unfortunately it flew just as fast sideways as it did fore and aft. The most unstable thing you ever come across. It had enormous great fins and rudders to try and stop it and make it more stable, but it didn't work. So while I was there, actually, that's when D-Day took place. I went back to the squadron, which had at that time shifted across the channel, and I was sent back to Swanton Morley. I'd finished my tour. I did 37 sorties, so it was 31 ops I was credited with. I was flying spare crews and mail and you name it, backwards and forwards across to Europe and to France and Belgium. And I was in Brussels when the Germans made their breakthrough in the Ardennes. And I was in the middle of the airfield in Brussels, I don't remember the name of the place, it was the main airport. and the bloody Germans come across and they strafe. The Yanks had all the liberators and all their marauders and stuff. They were all lined up beautifully along the runway. And all they had to do was just go straight down the row and squirt a lot of them, and they must have burnt, oh, I don't know, 50 aircraft there went up in a puff of smoke. God, they're joking, man. But I didn't like the feel of the bullets going through the grass as I was tiptoeing very quickly through a little trench. It was horrible. Anyway, that was part of that story. And then I met up with another chap from Hastings, Jack Grant, a chemist's son, whom I'd known for a long time. And Jack was having a few problems with his pilot. He was a navigator. So I said, oh, well, we'll go and have a go on mosquitoes. So I walked into the orderly room and we talked about this and went to the adjutant and said, what about going back? And he said, no. I said, sorry, Brunt, you're going home. So I was forthwith transferred to Brighton, waited the turn, and in due course went home. VE Day was celebrated in the Indian Ocean, and His Majesty told the captain to splice the rain brace. So there was about, I don't know how many people on board, there were quite a lot of us. That's the first time I've had a rum on the house.
You brought in a couple of interesting things. Talking about the Buckmaster, the only aircraft of that particular type that got into service was the Bristol Brigand, and that got into service towards the end of the war. And it was powered by the Bristol Centurious motor, and that's the biggest motor that Bristol ever produced.
28 cylinders.
That's right.
Four banks of seven.
And, of course, the famous Sea Fury powered by
that's
the...
That's right. They had trouble identifying them with the Focke Wulf. Was it the Focke Wulf?
Yes, 190.
Yeah. But the motors were fabulous. When we had those aircraft, they gave us six. That's all. They were the first ones off the assembly line. I remember one of the fellas was in one of these aircraft starting up on the tarmac, and the bloody thing backfired. And it was just like, I often laugh about it, he had wings out here, and he went, yo, 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 bang! And it just went, one wing crap. The air intake was one of the roots of the wings. They were enormous engines. Those air intakes would have been about that square, you know, great big thing.
Yes.
Well, when it took off, because we're doing proper trials with these things, and we had gallons meters. Well, where you're idling or moving around, the tenths of gallons just went sort of flick, 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 flick. On takeoff, the gallons, you couldn't read it. It just spun around. I think it does about 120 gallons a minute, something like that. Oh, God, did it get through some stuff?
Yeah, I was trying to think of the other one. The other one was the Buckmaster. That was the three that Bristol brought out. And you're the first person I've actually known that flew the...
Through the Bristol Buckingham. Yeah, it was quite fast. I remember one day we were flying along and an American Lightning took a fancy to us and they pulled up alongside. You know, they couldn't make it out. They'd never seen the thing before. They didn't know what to do about it. And we just sort of played around for a bit, and then I just opened the throttles and I just left them for dead. Just couldn't catch it. One of the things that I found quite interesting, we'd been over to Cherbourg and bombed the docks and the port. And as I say, we fly in a box of six. There's formation all the time. No matter what the leader does, he does all sorts of evasive action and stuff, and you've got to be there in position, and it was very taxing on us. But anyway, it was all for our own defence. Each turret had its own sector to keep an eye on, and we'd been across, and it was a pretty rough, you know, we got shot at a lot. We were about three quarters of the way across the channel. It's fairly wide at that point, and all of a sudden, everybody, the bloody guns were going off in all directions. One aircraft was shot down and another one was pretty badly knocked about. Not our aircraft, but these fighters. It turned out to be two Americans that were coming out of the sun. We thought, oh gee, we'd be in trouble now about this business. Because there were standing orders. You weren't allowed over the coast unless you're on legitimate business. So they were breaking the rules anyway. But when we got back to base, the Air Vice Marshal, who happened to be Air Vice Marshal Basil Embry, well known, he was there and he congratulated everybody on doing a bloody good job, because he knew all about it before we got back.
Well, thank you, Dick. Thank you for that experience. It was very interesting. I knew you'd been at Boscombe Down, because I think you'd alluded to that once before when I was chatting with you.
Oh, I could have mentioned it, yes. I enjoyed Boscombe Down. They had 148 different aircraft on that station. They had all the German aircraft, they had all the American ones. Every aircraft that had been produced, I think, was on that station. Even the latest Meteor, or the original Meteor. That was interesting too, insofar they used to have a tape measure and they took it over a little button on the front of the fuselage and they used to measure the length of the aircraft every day. bomb I was there, it stretched 4.5 inches.